You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey, people. It's the Long Form Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff from Atavist, and I'm joined by the Long Form guys, Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Feeling that hey people intro.
Hey. Ho.
Hey, party people.
Who did you talk to this week, Aaron?
See, I almost had to throw it to myself there, but I pulled the brakes at the last second. I talked to Jonathan Shannon from The Caravan, which is a Indian magazine. I think one of the only publishers of long feature material in India in English. He's an interesting guy. Just running a magazine out of Delhi is.
Didn't he also run one out of like Abu Dhabi?
He also ran a magazine out of Abu Dhabi. So some really good stories in here. If you want to send out some good stories yourself, you might need a newsletter from the good people at MailChimp. Comes Tiny Letter, a simple, powerful way to send an email newsletter. Thank you for your support.
Take it away, Aaron.
Hello, Jonathan Shannon.
Hello, Aaron. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very good. Welcome to America.
Thank you.
For people who aren't familiar with it, Jonathan is the editor of Caravan, which I have heard described as the Indian New Yorker.
Yeah, I am.
Do you like that description, or do you?
Well, I should as a point of clarification, I said I am senior editor at the Caravan.
There are two
people above me.
Okay.
In practice, we're a harmonious team, and you know, tend to do things together. And I am definitely the person who puts the pen to the paper. The New Yorker of India. I like that. I mean, it's the easiest way to explain what it is. And I think both to Indians who have not heard of it or to people here who are asking me, like, well, what kind of magazine is it? What are you guys trying to do? I find it to be a very functional description.
So let's rewind.
Yeah.
Because as far as I know, you're the only American I know that's editing a magazine in India. And I'm interested in how you ended up editing a magazine in India.
Well, yeah, it was a bit of an accident. I came to India 3 years ago. I had been in Abu Dhabi, and maybe we'll come back around to that.
Let's double rewind here. How did you come to edit a magazine in Abu Dhabi?
Well, okay, so there I was working at a newspaper. I think the best way to tell this story is to, you know, fade in to, you know, the offices of the New Yorker in, I don't know, maybe like September 2007. And I'm sitting at my desk in the fact-checking department, and I get an email from a guy in Abu Dhabi who was a former New York Times reporter. At the time, he was still with the New York Times, totally out of the blue, basically saying, hello, I'm starting a new newspaper in Abu Dhabi, and some people have recommended you. We're looking for a culture editor. And what I learned later, I guess, was that a few people in New York had mentioned me as someone who was like kind of interested in the Middle East and had kind of a background in. I had worked at the New Yorker. I had worked as one of Bob Silvers' assistants at the New York Review. You know, someone who had a kind of culture literary kind of bent. So I took a job working for The National, which at the time was launching. So I got there in December 2007. And the paper launched in April 2008. And my job, which wasn't really defined before I moved out there, came to be creating and then editing a kind of weekly magazine within the newspaper. We had a little front of the book. We had kind of an op-ed page. We would do one cover story every week that was usually about 4,000 or 5,000 words. And more often than not was, you know, long-form reporting. Sometimes it would be an essay. And then there was a lot of kind of books and arts coverage. So, you know, we would have three or four long book reviews.
What is in someplace like Abu Dhabi, what does books and arts mean, and what are you covering there?
Well, we took a pretty broad view of that. I mean, when I came there, I think my thought was, okay, what do people here have in common? You know, our readership is reading in English. It's not an Arabic language paper. So I sort of thought, well, okay, most of the people here are from somewhere else. They're interested in the Middle East because they live in Abu Dhabi, or they're interested in the Gulf. And, you know, I took it to be sort of like, all right, we need to be sort of internationally minded, you know? And I thought about, okay, how does like an American publication look outward at the rest of the world, where, you know, maybe New York or London is kind of like the center of that world, and the subjects that the magazine or the newspaper is interested in, you know, vary based on their proximity either to the interests of the home country or to how far away they are. You know, so if you're in America, you know, you certain things are interesting in Mexico, certain things are interesting in Iraq or Afghanistan because we have troops there, things like that. So my thought was like, all right, how do you flip that on its head and put Abu Dhabi at the center of the world? And you don't necessarily write about Abu Dhabi because most of what's happening in Abu Dhabi is pretty boring. And we're also attached to a newspaper that's covering the UAE, right, you know, 7 days a week. How do we sort of rethink, you know, we're going to be writing about a lot of the same books that you'd be reading about in a paper here, but, you know, maybe we're going to pass over things that, you know, we're not necessarily going to do, like a new Martin Amis book, or, you know, we're going to pay extra close attention to fiction by Arab writers, Indian writers, Pakistani writers, African writers. And similarly for the journalism, I feel like I tried to think about, like, what's close to us. So we did a lot of Iraq.
Yeah.
War was going on then. We did a couple Afghanistan pieces. We covered the rest of the Middle East, you know, Hezbollah, Egypt, stuff like that. But then also I tried to think about, again, like, what are the issues and themes that are really relevant to life here?
Were you able to write about, like, the slave labor? Like, it's interesting because everything you're describing, I'm like, I don't know if I would read the, like, Abu Dhabi review of books, but I would read the Abu Dhabi review of slave labor in Abu Dhabi.
We wrote about it a fair bit. I mean, you had to walk a line there. You know, we were, you know, the paper was owned by the government. You know, you need a license in the UAE even to run a newspaper. So if the government doesn't like what you're doing, they can shut you down whether they own you or not. So, we wrote about local issues the mandate was kind of do it in a sensitive way. So don't go looking for trouble, but you don't have to hide that this stuff is going on. So we did, one of the best pieces we did in Abu Dhabi, and maybe the piece that I'm most proud of actually, was by a writer named John Gravois, who now works at Pacific Standard out in California. New magazine.
Yeah, I've been hearing a lot about that.
And he profiled a woman who we wanted to write about remittances and about, you know, this economy that, you know, the Philippines, Pakistan, Bangladesh, India, these places that are basically kept afloat by, or regions in these countries that are kept afloat by workers in the Gulf sending money home. And he found a Filipina woman who her job was, she was like a remittance agent. So when like a new crew of workers would come into town, she worked for like a money transferring firm. She would go kind of befriend them, and kind of rather than waiting for them to come like downtown to deposit their money, she would go to them. And she developed these like amazing relationships with all these people, and she knew all these guys by name, and she would help their wives get visas to come visit. And, you know, so we did stories like that, which were, I think, examinations of that world. I think we tried not to moralize about it, which I actually think in some ways, I'm not a defender of the UAE, but I think in some ways is not, you can't write about it like an outsider, you know? You have to be sensitive to the cruelty that is often inflicted on people who come to do these jobs, but you can't just sort of like stand at a remove and say like, no, this is not good for you. You should go back to your home country, you know?
So when what brought you away from Abu Dhabi?
Well, yeah, the unvarnished story, which I guess I've told enough now, is just that basically I kind of fell out with my editors. There was a change in management at the newspaper. They wanted everything to be shorter and cheaper, And so they cut the budget for my section, and they, you know, we used to do 4,000 words on the cover every week, and they were like, from now on, no story can be longer than 2,000 words. I mean, the idea of the Abu Dhabi paper originally, which I think is so amazing, is like, I think, was this sense, sort of reverse logic, where someone in Abu Dhabi said, great cities have great newspapers, and we want to be a great city, so we have to start a newspaper. I mean, it's very old-fashioned, yeah. I think, reverse causality way of thinking. And, you know, there was a sense that this section that I was running was going to, you know, be an ambassador for the newspaper outside of Abu Dhabi. And then they just lost interest in that, you know. So I decided, okay, Abu Dhabi's also like a tough place to live. I mean, it's...
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, what was your life like while you were there?
I mostly worked all the time. It was really like being at camp in a way, because we all... It was a very strange experience. I mean, someday someone who I worked with will like write a novel about this. We all lived in these buildings that the company had either bought or I guess the company had rented out the whole building. So you had these kind of like 200 foreigners, mostly Westerners, some Arabs and South Asians, who had all moved to Abu Dhabi to work for this newspaper. We all knew only one another, at least for a while, and we all lived in these buildings together. You know, so you'd have like a fight with someone at the office. If you had a fight with someone at the office, then you'd like come home and see them in the lobby of the building, you know, because you lived in a dorm. But I really enjoyed being there. I mean, I think the experience of working in an environment that's foreign and where you have to kind of think through a lot of things from the ground up. This has been my experience in India too. I find it to be really stimulating, I guess, to have to interrogate the assumptions that you have as an editor about like what's interesting, what's not interesting, what's a good story, what's a bad story, what's the story that's been done a million times already. I feel like when you get out of a place that is your place, which for me and you is America or New York, you have to kind of think through some things in a fresh way. And I think that can be really productive.
What brought you from Abu Dhabi to Caravan is in Delhi?
Caravan is in Delhi. Basically, I was ready to leave Abu Dhabi, and I started talking to friends and trying to find out what other options were out there. And I really liked being away. I mean, I'd been gone for 3 years, and I felt like I just like wasn't ready to come back to America. I think work here had started to pick up again. I missed like the real bad years. But I guess I had like this bug for like being an editor abroad, and I had gotten to be really interested in India because, again, going back to this sense of kind of what does the world look like when you put Abu Dhabi at the center of it? India looms very large there, both in terms of it, the size of the country, the size of the population, the proximity to the Gulf, and then, of course, the fact that you have a large Indian population in the UAE. So some friends of mine put me in touch with people at Caravan. And
this is after going on hiatus. It is a historical publication.
Yeah, so it had been... It existed from, I believe, 1940 until 1988. I've never actually read a copy of the original run of Caravan. As far as I know, it was totally different. It's been described to me as being like a little like Reader's Digest or something, but I don't even know if that's true. I think it was a literary magazine in the sense that I think it probably published a lot of like poetry and short stories and things like that. And the grandson of the guy who founded it, so it's part of this family business, which is called Delhi Press. It was founded by this guy, Vishwanath, in 1940. You or any of our listeners have read Naipaul's third nonfiction book about India, which has the most amazing title ever. It's called India, A Million Mutinies Now. There's a chapter on this guy, Vishwanath, who started the company. So he passed the company to his son, and that guy's son is my boss. He came to the U.S. to do a master's at Columbia, and as I understand it, this is Anant, you know, fell in love with Harper's and the New Yorker and the Atlantic and came back to India and was like, hey, why don't we do this? And what do you know? My company is in the magazine publishing business. We'll have a go at this. So he started it, I think it was a bi-monthly for a while. And then in the beginning of 2010, it got a kind of relaunch in its present form, you know, once a month with this kind of narrative journalism angle to it. So when I first got in touch with them, they had just done the relaunch and basically said to me, look, if you end up moving here, get back in touch with us. And by 6 months later, I was pretty much just ready to go to India. And I called them up and, you know, they said, all right, we've got a job now. It's very serendipitous. I mean, I feel like I was incredibly lucky to like find, here's like the one magazine in this whole country that does exactly what I love.
So what, tell me about what the, like that first month in India was like. I mean, immersing yourself and it's a pretty big shift.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had, so, you know, I mentioned before that I'm the senior editor. Above me, there is Anant, who's our owner. And then my sort of direct boss, who is, you know, in practice is kind of my partner, is a guy named Vinod Jose, who has done some of our biggest stories. He's a journalist. He, you know, I learned an enormous amount about Indian politics and Indian media from him. And we'd sit and talk together for hours and hours every day. Basically, I just, it was like drinking from a fire hose. I, you know, got there. I subscribed to like six newspapers. I subscribed to every magazine that comes out. I mean, like the four or five kind of weekly magazines. And I just started like reading and reading and reading. I learned an enormous amount on Twitter, which sounds ridiculous. But I think what I was interested in was kind of, you know, first you want to get to grips with the facts. I mean, I read books and I looked at histories and things like that. But I feel like as an editor, you really want to get at this kind of like meta layer that's like, how do people talk about what's going on? Like, I know what's going on, but like, you know, what are the jokes people make about this politician, or like, what is the reputation of this thing or this party or this ministry? And that, I think, it's just sort of this osmosis. You have to just like take in a volume of information. And at the beginning, you don't really know what you're going to do with all of it, but you kind of think, okay, well, I'll like join up the dots later. And then I think for me, what made it possible, or what was, I was lucky, I guess, was that it was my job to do this stuff. So I would have a kind of overview knowledge of something, and then we would do a huge piece, and I would then have to, in order to edit that piece, to be working with the reporter, to be sort of doing the fact-checking as I edit the story, and to be doing the like, you know, kind of heavy editing that we do, I would have to learn, you know, maybe not everything the reporter knows, but like I wanted to know as much as possible. So I would read the transcripts of the interviews the reporter would do. Sometimes I'd read books about, you know, the politics of Tamil Nadu or something. I felt like I just wanted to know enough so that, often driven by kind of fear of embarrassment.
How do you manage a country the size of India and the number of stories that are coming out? How do you keep a handle on that?
In some ways, it's just an extension of, I think, the problem of just magazine editing generally. I mean, I have my sort of philosophy, if that's the right word, of what it means to be a magazine editor, is that you start with this blank thing every month. You know, I mean, if you're doing this kind of long form stuff, if you're a monthly magazine as we are, there's nothing you have to put in the magazine. You know, we're not covering stuff. In a way where I feel like if you're, you know, you're the editor of a newspaper or something, you got a pretty good sense of what's going to go in tomorrow's newspaper because you know what happened today. So I think you start from the sense of like, okay, what's compelling enough that it's worth 6,000 words? And then what's the 6,000 word story that a reader, someone who's not like a fanatic for long form journalism, a reader is going to be like, whoa, I got to read this, you know? So I think one of the things we've tried really hard to do has been to be pretty topical in terms of picking subjects that we think is sort of like, okay, this is news that's going to stay news. Because it takes us 4 or 5 months to do a story sometimes. So, you know, you want to know when you send out that reporter in December that come May or June, either the subject is important enough or that what you're going to unearth is new enough that it's going to feel, when it comes out, someone's going to be like, holy shit, I got to read this. You know, my line that I now have, like the people who work with me now, I think we all kind of repeat it as a mantra, is like, you know, there are two things for us. One is this idea of like, we're gonna do three stories a month for 12 months a year. So when a story idea comes up, it's like, is this one of 36? We're like, we got 36 slots here. And is this story that we're talking about worthy of being one of those 36? I think the other thing, and this comes, I think, in some ways with this question of like, what do you do from, you know, local or regional subjects, is like, why are we doing this particular story? You know, so all over India, for example, there is like massive environmental despoiling going on, you know, mining, power plants, forests getting cut down. I mean, it's kind of, you could go to pretty much any place and you would find someone breaking the law or bribing an official or, you know, dispossessing indigenous tribals from their land to mine it. But you can't write all those stories, you know, and there's a kind of sameness about them if you keep writing them over and over again. So it's kind of, you're looking for, you know, we have a story coming up that is about, people use this word in India, tribals, or Adivasis is what they're called, sort of native inhabitants of the land. They're, you know, indigenous peoples. And these are the people who have borne a lot of the brunt of kind of the rapid development of the last two decades. And there's a community of these people in Maharashtra, actually, where they're really isolated, and the district that they're in has the highest rate of death due to starvation in the entire country. And we have like a grant that we were doing with a nonprofit, an NGO, where we were kind of, you know, funding reporting. You know, we'd get like, you know, these people would kind of top up the cost of what it would take for a reporter to go to a story. So I've had a guy who's been back and forth to this fairly remote place like six times, you know, and gotten to know these people and, you know, spent a lot of time with them. And there I feel like, you know, corny or not, the hook is like, this is the worst place. You know, this is the place that's number one. So at least like you can, there's something to sell it with. That sounds really crass, but I feel like that's, you know, when we're talking about like doing a piece on a politician or, you know, doing a piece on a movie star or something like that, it's like, okay, well, why this guy? You know, like we need to be able to answer that question. You know, why are we doing this story instead of any of the nine fairly similar stories we could do?
Who is the writer who you're sending to this area six times, and who are the people who write for the caravan, and how do you develop talent?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the hardest thing, I think, because there's not a pool of freelance writers. I mean, you can't make a living in India as a freelance writer. I mean, we don't pay that much money, and we can't even keep you that busy. I mean, if you were like really devoted to writing for Caravan, maybe you do four stories in a year. The guy we're sending to this area, this place, it's called Melghat, is a guy named Anosh Malakar, who is a newspaper reporter, who's based in Pune.
So, in terms of you, Caravan being the only more long-form English language outlet, when you have writers coming from a newspaper environment or coming from a shorter magazine environment, and you're assigning that first 5 or 10,000 word story, are you like, you know, here's a stack of Xerox John Lee Anderson stories, please study these? How do you guide someone through writing their first feature?
Yeah, we do a little bit of that. I mean, I give people a lot of New Yorker stories. I feel like you have to not just give someone a story, you have to kind of tell them how you want them to read it in a way. I mean, there are a couple of stories where I latch on to these weird things, particularly in the New Yorker. Like, you know, it's like it's no use to give anyone like a David Grand story, because unless you're writing a story that has a David Grand story plot line,
yeah,
reading David Grand is not going to help. You
yeah,
know? It's there, probably going to mess you up.
Is
actually.
There a twist in here
yeah.
where
like, yeah, unless
a murder enters the narrative yeah. more than 2/3 of the way through?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, unless Act 3 of your profile has like a shocking reveal, then yeah. like you don't need to. But, you know, I've been you know, this is like an odd, and I latch on to weird things. Lauren Collins, who I like a lot and who I once worked with at The New Yorker, did this profile of April Bloomfield, the chef at the Spotted Pig.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know that that's, I mean, I like that piece a lot. I'm not sure that it's like a masterpiece, but it has a great kind of first 1,000 words where there's a fantastic opening scene, and Lauren has just like packed in an enormous amount of background information while she's narrating the opening scene in a way that's very unobtrusive and doesn't seem forced. And so I have, you know, on like 9 or 10 occasions, like given this to someone and said, like, don't read this whole piece, but like, look at the first section of this story and how all these different kinds of material come together, how there's like, okay, there's kind of live scene being narrated and there's the author's voice and then there's background information and then there are quotes happening, and like trying to like show people how you build, you know, how all these different elements you have to have in a piece. So there's a lot, I mean, I spend a lot of my time, whether it's with the staff writers who already work for us or it's with new people who are doing something for the first time, it's like a huge amount of my job is just talking to people. And I really like that, actually. But I sometimes feel like, you know, I'm like teaching at a journalism school, which is great, actually. You know, sitting down and trying to kind of get a writer to see the piece the way that I see it or the way that I think I might see it, and trying to like, it's like a mix of like high concept sort of like, okay, here's how you want to think, like telling people things like, okay, like I want time to pass in your story, you know, like I want your story to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and I want it to feel like time passes within the universe of the story. I want there to be a real mix of, you know, live scene, you know, kind of scenes, background, quotes, your observations, parenthetical aside, you know, kind of, I have all these dopey metaphors that I use with people. So I often talk about how, you know, imagine you're like building like a shack out of like detritus and very, you know, you're gonna like need a little bit of tin and a little bit of plywood and like a window and kind of, you know, or I make drawings for people. I have a like a ridiculous repertoire of absurd kind of like pictogram, my favorite of which involves an island. So I will like sit with a reporter, I don't know why, and I'll draw this stupid island on a piece of paper. And I, you know, in the island metaphor, the conceit is that you are marooned on this desert island and for some reason you have to make a map of the island, I don't know why, as a way of sort of explaining my sense of how the reporting process for a piece like this should go. So I will tell people, you know, okay, well, so you're making a map of this island. The first thing you're going to do for the first 2 or 3 weeks is you're just going to like walk around the perimeter of the island. You're going to like draw the coastline. And you're going to get a sense of what's in the island or what's on the island and what's not on the island, you know? And then, like, once you got that down, you're going to sort of subdivide the island into kind of grid squares. And then you're going to try and figure out, where do I need to just sort of cursorily pass over an aspect of the story? And where do I need to go really deep? You know, like, where is going to be that one point in my finished story where I'm going to have, like, a tight TikTok of, like, what happened on the critical day or, you know, what was the chain of events that led up to, you know, someone's resignation or, you know, and I'm just trying to get across to people, like, how do you gather the information you're going to need to get a story that has the feel that we want? And I think that my guess, I don't know what it's like, I've not done this here, but I think, you know, here people have a bit more of an intuitive sense of that. And if you're dealing with someone who's never written a story like this before or has maybe only done one or two, I feel like this kind of coaching, you know, saves you a lot of time at the end, you know, but you have to get it. What I find is that even people who read The New Yorker don't necessarily get what goes into making a story like that. This is where, for me, I think in a way, like being a fact checker was like an amazing job.
Who are your readers? I mean, how much do you know about them?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we get a lot of our feedback, I think, comes from social media. And we, I mean, it's funny, you know, we're a kind of old-fashioned magazine in that, you know, it's print and it's monthly and it's edited in a very laborious way. Social media has been huge and hugely important for us. I mean, I think I leave it to others to probably say how much the reputation of Caravan has grown in the last couple of years. But I think whatever that growth has been, it's been really heavily driven by people reading stuff on the internet. And you know, when we do a big piece, I hate this phrase, goes viral. And now people have started to use this as a verb, like it viraled. I had a story viral. I've seen this in Indian publications. It drives me crazy. When we do a big, big story, you know, and some of these are like, you know, like the probably the first really big story maybe we had in terms of web readership was this profile of Manmohan Singh, who's the prime minister. And that's like a super unsexy story. I mean, this guy's on TV every day. I mean, he's the most, depending on who you believe, arguably the most powerful person in the country. Many people would say he's not. But, you know, structurally, he's the head of the government. And that was like, you know, Vinod spent like 6 months, interviewed like 60 people who had known Manmohan like across his whole life. And that went up online and it just like spread like wildfire. People were like, oh my God, you got to read this. There was nothing like this has been done before. So it's, you know, the reason I bring up Twitter is because I think, or Twitter and Facebook, is because that's how I get a sense of who's reading stuff. But I feel like it's a little dangerous because it's like, it's like that like old joke where the guy's looking for his car keys under the light, yeah, under the lamp light, right? And the cop is like, did you lose your keys here? And he's like, no, but here's where the light is. You know, like Twitter tells you something. And so it's tempting to think that it's the real, like, because it's a metric you can see.
Yeah.
It's tempting to think that that's the whole universe.
Do, when a story sort of starts circulating on Twitter like that, and I'm thinking of, there was a cricket story a year or two ago, who was like sort of a veteran guy, and then he got involved in organizing the league or something.
Well, so the big one we did, which you guys actually very nicely picked as, I think, a top 10 of the year under the sports category, was about this guy, Lalit Modi.
Yes, that's the one I'm like, sorry, Max is our sports editor, but I did read that.
So this guy created this new league, which was playing this like short form of cricket, and it was like a massive spectacle, celebrities, after parties, cheerleaders, which don't really go with cricket. And then he got caught up in various scandals and basically had to like leave. He left the country, actually.
And so when a story like that, does that reach a wider swath of India? Not simply in the sense of traffic, but in the sense of, oh, this is the kind of person I would not expect to read The Caravan, but because this is a cricket story or whatever, this can go further.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's cricket. I mean, people are as obsessed with politics as they are with cricket to a degree. I think that's definitely right. I mean, I think that like the core, you know, there's a kind of core Indian Twitter sphere to me that probably is popular. I don't know all of these people, but I imagine it's like 50 or 100,000 people at most, you know? And it's interesting because India is, you know, it's a big country and people are really spread out. So I think, am I not to sound like Jeff Jarvis or something like that, but I think that there is a way in which the web has been transformative because there's a kind of discussion that can now be had among people who are, you know, one guy in Bangalore and one guy in Bombay and a woman in Chennai and someone else who's in kind of rural Rajasthan and a woman in Kashmir. And, you know, these are people who wouldn't have talked to one another previously for geographic reasons, among others. So, you know, there's like, yeah, a core group of people who I think, you know, every time we do a big piece, they'll be tweeting it. And I think it's definitely the case. And I'm kind of like relentless. I'm a relentless monitor of like, in, you know, like I'm like constantly refreshing the like who's posting links to our stories on Twitter. I think when the bigger the story, yeah, the ripples are wider, you know, and so it's going to get out to people who've never heard of Caravan before. These tend to be political stories. I mean, I think
I feel like the opposite is true in the U.S. Like, political stories have the shortest reach in the U.S.
Yeah. Well, see, part of it, I mean, again, part of it is, like, politics is a big spectator sport. I also think that we, you know, have a bit of this kind of brand with these political profiles where, you know, people will almost, sometimes I'll see people share them in a very sort of like informative, like, hey, you've got to read this to know about this guy. This is the story that's going to tell you everything about this controversial politician.
If I asked an Indian person who read The Caravan, do you have like, you know, you would say The New Republic, this is a liberal publication, The National Review, this is a conservative publication. Where is Caravan on the political spectrum?
That's a hard question to answer. I think Caravan is the Indian political spectrum is a little different. So I think Caravan is a secular publication, which is a word that has a sort of specific valence in India. You know, I would say that it's of a liberal inclination. Mm-hmm. You know, I started my career, or whatever one calls it, my first job was at The Nation. I was an intern at The Nation. I worked for Alex Coburn, among other people. And I loved it, but it gave me like an allergy to like polemical political writing, which I now loathe and I find really, really tedious. So one of the biggest pieces I think we've done was this profile of Narendra Modi, who is the chief minister of Gujarat and far and away the most controversial politician in India and one of the most popular politicians in India and someone who is seen as the most likely candidate for the BJP, the right-leaning party, to be the prime minister, to be their prime ministerial candidate for 2014. And, you know, Modi is a guy who just, like, controversy swirls around him. He has, like, avid fans and, you know, rabid fans and avid detractors, however you want to think about it. And that was a piece where, you know, in terms of the politics of it, my goal as the editor was to play it as straight as possible. You know, his one of the reasons why he's so controversial is because shortly after he became chief minister, which happened at the end of 2001, there were these riots in Gujarat in 2002. I think 1,000 or 2,000 people were killed, most of them Muslims. And the controversy about him has, you know, in large part circulated around whether he was aware of this, complicit, did he not, you know, step in soon enough to stop the rioting? And I think, you know, for me, the goal was to produce a piece that would be read by both sides of the issue. The people who love Modi hated the piece, or most of them hated the piece. But, you know, just not to moralize, to kind of just to play it straight, basically, you know? I mean, I think, you know, we have a broadly liberal worldview, but I don't want it to seem like we have an agenda, I guess.
What is your day-to-day life in India like? What is the life of a magazine editor, an American magazine editor living in India?
I spend a lot of time at my office. I mean, I live in South Delhi. I live by myself in like a small, it's like a sort of small house. I wake up in the morning, I eat breakfast, or try to eat breakfast. I take an auto rickshaw to work, except in the summer. In the summer, I take the metro because it's too hot to be outside. So I walk out of my neighborhood probably, you know, 10 minutes. I get in an auto rickshaw. I got to negotiate with the guys every morning.
What is a ride to work in an auto rickshaw cost?
If they ran the meter, which they don't usually, it's 95 rupees, which is a little less than $2. My sort of personal limit is 150, which is about $3. Guys will want to charge. You know, there's like a kind. You pay a kind of white man tax, right? People look at me and they're like, "All right, yeah, that's 500." Yeah. You know, which is like five times the normal price. I like to smoke in the auto rickshaw on the way to work, so I kind of prefer that to the metro. And then, you know, I get to my office. Caravan office is pretty small. We have probably about 15 people in the office.
What is your social life like?
You know, it's mostly mostly people who I kind of either people I know from work. I mean, I feel like there's a hammy line that I've used many times before, and I will now use again that. You know, I'm not an Indian, but I am an Indian journalist, which is stupid, but also true. I mean, I work at an Indian magazine that's read by Indians primarily. So most of my friends are other journalists. Some of them are writers I work with, like Samanth. Some are people who work at, you know, other newspapers or, you know, they're freelance writers. I've gotten to know like a lot of people. I mean, I feel... Delhi has gotten to the point now, and Delhi is a small town. I mean, it's 20 million people, obviously, but like the sort of like literary journalistic Delhi can be a small town, you know. So if I go to, you know, a few weeks ago, there was a little party for Mohsin Hamid, who was coming through town to, you know, launch his new book. And I go to a party like that, and there are like 50 people there, and I know 40 of them because they're just like, it's not that, you know, it's not a big place.
Has it been strange for you to make a life in India? I mean, do you date in India?
Well, no, I haven't. I mean, I have a girlfriend who lives in America. No, it's not really. I mean, people, you know, I think it's not that weird to be. I don't know how to describe this. I mean, it's. I'm hyper conscious of being an outsider in a way. I for a long time refused to write anything about India. People would ask me, and I would say no, mostly because I was afraid I would embarrass myself somehow. I'm really conscious of sort of not wanting to be the guy from the outside who comes and stands in judgment and, you know, says, like, here's what I think is going on. And, you know, it's like I have strong opinions about aspects of how the Indian media works. And, you know, sometimes I'm vocal about that stuff, but at other times I feel like, okay, it's not my place to, you know, like you never want to be like, oh, I'm the white hero who's come from outside. I mean, I've heard people have said to me, you know, it's so great that you've brought this journalism to India. And I'm kind of like, no, I didn't bring anything, you know, like I'm a good editor and I do my job, but you know, it's not, I didn't introduce this, you know?
What's it like reading? I mean, do you read, it's a terrible example, but I'm thinking of like Catherine Boo's book came out this last year, and you know, a fair amount gets written about India by outsiders and is read pretty widely in America. And I think it's probably a lot of people's sort of primary impression of India is from it. What is it like when you read those outsider accounts?
Well, I mean, the quality varies, I think. I mean, I'm probably nastier about some of this stuff than I should be. I think I have a reputation among other foreign journalists in Delhi as being like that guy on Twitter who's going to say that your piece was bullshit, or who's going to make fun of you when you write a story about monkeys in Delhi, as if that's news. Kate Boo's book is, I think, is like a masterpiece. And I mean, I wrote a review of that for Book Forum. I think the level of commitment that she put in and the sort of like... that to me it's what I want everything to be like in a way. I mean, just sort of like relentlessly focused on telling a small story, not on trying to sort of, I mean, it's like, that's not a book that's about like drawing conclusions from stuff. You know, it's basically about like, here's the way this thing is. I realize that's an illusion to a degree, but, you know, I think that, some writers come, and often I think maybe this is driven by the perceived needs of the news desk, you know, back in New York or back in London, with a kind of preconceived storyline. And they go looking for stories that validate the storyline or that, you know, are notable because of the storyline. I think the people whose work I really appreciate are people who are much more open just to kind of like learning from India and kind of immersing themselves and just letting things be what they are. Not, it's a sort of idea that I think defines a lot of journalism, actually, that like things have to be emblematic of something else, you know? So when you do a story in the New York Times about Dharavi, which is the big slum in Mumbai, It's not about Dharavi. It's about like the idea of slums, you know. And I feel like one of the things that's great about Kate Boo's book is that like it doesn't try to be more than it is. You know, it's like it's a microscopic and very precise portrait of this very specific place. And I'm sure there are bits in the book where, you know, Kate ventures a bit beyond that and, you know, draws some conclusions. But it's not like it's not making an example of anything. And that's what I find irritating. You know, is this attempt to kind of like take some singular thing and kind of construe it as like, oh, this tells us everything we need to know about India.
It's interesting because my next question was going to do that exactly, which was to ask. So you've been in India 3 years now?
Almost 3 years, yeah.
Do you see changes in India? Like so much of what's written about India is sort of about the new India and how quickly things are evolving and so forth. As someone who has been there, not for a long time, but long enough, has Delhi changed in your time there?
I don't know that Delhi has changed exactly. And I'm not someone who like spends a lot of time like out on the street, right? I mean, I take my auto rickshaw to work and back. There's huge swaths of Delhi that I've never set foot in. I mean, Delhi's like an enormous city. What has changed, I think, so I'm really interested in what I think of as being sort of like the elite or kind of middle class Anglophone discourse, which is basically like what you read in the English language newspapers, what people talk about on TV, what people in South Delhi talk about over their dinner tables kind of stuff. And I think the storyline that I'm interested in is that there was a great deal of optimism among this class in the late 2000s, maybe like through kind of 2008, 2009. The economy was growing really fast. India seemed to be kind of earning a new level of respect on the world stage. And that has kind of slowly and steadily unraveled from kind of 2010 onwards. And you can, if you're paying close attention to anyone listening in India will appreciate this, that, you know, it started with the Commonwealth Games, which came to Delhi in 2010 and were, you know, everything was like not done on time and the buildings were falling apart. And then all of these officials who were involved in planning this thing ended up in jail for corruption. And kind of from then onward, it was sort of like scam after scam after scam. And the economy started slowing down and you had the rise of this big anti-corruption protest movement that really galvanized a lot of middle-class Indians who were kind of like, you know, mad as hell and not going to take it anymore, so to speak. So I think there's like a real, I don't know, there's like, it's not despair exactly, but I mean, there's this like sense of kind of like promise betrayed. And I think it's curdled a bit. I mean, I think there's some corners of this elite or this kind of upper middle class that are really angry. I mean, the government of the day, which is headed by the Congress Party, is truly loathed by a lot of people. And in some ways, that loathing is totally justified because the government is incompetent and it's corrupt. I sometimes wonder whether the level of incompetence and corruption is sufficient to explain. I mean, I think like there are things that are wrong that can't all be pinned on the government. But I think that anger is like a new thing, you know, and I think it reflects again this sense of like, oh, what happened? We believed that this economic boom was going to kind of wash away, you know, caste discrimination, for example, you know, or, you know, gender violence. I mean, gender violence was not so much an issue back then, violence against women. I mean, that's been a post, you know, since January of this year when there was a huge, you know, Delhi rape case.
Is this something you can see yourself doing for a lifetime?
I don't know. I mean, it's the answer is probably no. I mean, I don't want to leave. It's like the most fun I've ever had. It's also, I'm a little burned out. I mean, it's not uncommon to, you know, sleep at the office for three or four nights at the end of the month. I think it's like the greatest place to be. I mean, I think it's an insanely fascinating country. I think it's a place where the kind of work that we are doing and that other journalists are doing is really appreciated because we're filling a niche that was not previously occupied. You know, I mean, I think you come back, I think if you started Caravan in America right now, no one would care. You know, there's like no, I mean, maybe some people would be into it, but like there's no shortage of this
You'd
kind of.
You'd be like in a warehouse in Bushwick. Yeah. Like.
Exactly. So, you know, on the other hand, I think, there's a limit, I think, to how long you can be in another place and how, you know, maybe it is a question of sort of deciding for me personally, like, okay, do I want my life to just be here? Or at some point, do I want to think about like, okay, I need to come back and figure out what it is I can do in America? You know, I think that as far as I'm concerned, like Caravan is like a never-ending project. You know, I can, you know, I think we've come a long way. But every month, I feel like, all right, we can make next month better than last month was.
And is it self-sustaining? I mean, if that auto rickshaw crashed, is it running on its own, or is it being pushed by you at this point?
No, it's never been pushed by me. We the story in terms of kind of personnel in the last couple of years has been that as the reputation of the magazine has grown and the circulation has grown, and the ad sales have gone up. You know, we're still not making money as a standalone entity. I mean, the company that we're a part of makes money on its other magazines. But we have expanded the staff. You know, we've been able to, you know, when I started, there was, you know, basically in terms of the editorial, you know, there was Vinod, there was me, there was a copy editor, there were a couple of like people who just like had worked on specific sections, and there was one staff writer who had, was like an intern who had been promoted up to being a staff writer and was being paid like peanuts. This is Meboob, who I think you put up a couple of his, he did this great story about the these Kashmiri guys who went over to Pakistan to fight in kind of the insurgency against India and then got stuck there started to sort of dribble back. Meboob is a great reporter. And one of these people is just like this really driven young guy. He's probably like 28, 29, who has a real skill, I think, at like getting people to trust him. So we've added three more staff writers. We've added three more editors. You know, it's increasingly starting to feel more like it's kind of like a real institution where, you know, there's like a hierarchy of people doing different things.
That seems like as good a place as any to taper off there. And thank you very much, Jonathan Shannon, for coming in. Cheers to you.
Thank you.
In here.
This is fantastic.
Our editor is Lauren Kirchner. My co-hosts are Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Our fantastic sponsor is Tiny Letter from the good people at MailChimp. We'll see you next week.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.
More to-dos, less time, and an infinite number of tools to keep track of. Sometimes doing business has never felt harder, but you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You can just use HubSpot, because their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: high-quality leads, fast-closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle. It's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.